The following Dharma discourse was given by Jeffrey Shugen Arnold at Zen Mountain Monastery. Shugen Roshi is the head of the Mountains and Rivers Order and abbot of the monastery. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you would like to make a donation or find out more about our various programs, visit us online at zmn.org. Thank you for listening.
This is from Master Dongshan's Jewel Mirror Samadhi poem. Part 4. Penetrate the source and you will fathom the way. In order to lead, there must be a road. To be wrong is auspicious. There is no contradiction. Innately pure, moreover subtle, no connection with delusion or enlightenment. Causes and conditions have their time and season, tranquil and illuminating. Fine enough to penetrate where there is no space, large enough to transcend its boundaries. Being off by the fraction of a hair's breadth, the attunement of major and minor keys is lost. Now there is sudden and gradual because principles and approaches have been set up. With the distinction of principles and approaches, standards arise. Even if one penetrates the principle and masters the approach, the true constant continues as a defiled outflow. Externally calm, internally shaking, like a tethered horse or a mouse frozen by fright. The former sages, having compassion for such people, made a gift of the Dharma. In their topsy-turvy state, people take black for white. But when their topsy-turvy thinking disappears, the acquiescent mind is self-acknowledged. So we are in our New Year's session. I hope things are going well for you at home in your various circumstances. New Year's, a beginning of a new year. We're at the beginning days of this session. Beginnings can be kind of nice because they're fresh. There can be energy in beginnings. In a way, it's easy to begin things. It's much harder to carry them through. And in beginnings, we sometimes have a mind that's a little bit more clear and fresh, hasn't really accumulated too much. And so as we strive for a mind and a heart that is open, free of hindrances, that is open and free of hindrances in our heart, in our views, in our voice, in our actions, we are moving closer to our original state. We call Buddha nature. That's what practice helps us to reveal, to discover, to bring out, to realize, to embody. We see that without so many concerns, without so many burdens, it's much easier, much more natural for loving kindness, compassion, generosity, patience to be available to us. So as we continue looking at this poem of Master Dongshan's, penetrate the source and you will fathom the way. In order to lead, there must be a road. In order to lead, in order to return, in order to die to the idea of the self and to come back to life, to realize the unborn, the undying. Although the Buddha realized that this is already originally so, that we are already such a person, there must be a road. And so the Buddha taught a path, a noble path. And what a good medicine that is for our sort of being entrenched in our linear, dualistic path to a goal, way of seeing pretty much everything. A path. We may have some sense of how or when it began, but in this path there is, in a sense, those subtle causing conditions that brings us to the Dharma. Could any of us ever fully know? And once begun, once it becomes a conscious path, we eventually see that there is no end. The very idea of an end is based in the way of thinking that we're trying to free ourselves of. If it had an end, it could not be a path to liberation. If it had an end, it would have a beginning. It would be something, which means eventually it would come apart. It would just be another disappointment. It has no end because that's its nature. It has no end because we have no end, and the path is nothing other than ourselves. And so the Buddha, in teaching the middle way, the middle path, spoke of it as the path between self-denial or self-mortification, an ascetic path, and a life of self-indulgence. He spoke of it as the three trainings of the precepts or morality and samadhi and prajna. We speak of it as the bodhisattva path. All one and the same. There are many or various teachings that talk about what is required to be able to practice the Dharma. Like, you know, I spoke a little bit, I think, on Monday night about how we can, because with printing and internet and technology and Buddhism being present within our own lives, we can think of it as something that's very easy to access, very easy to get to, very easy to get. And that's a problem. I mean, think about Dogen, who had spent so much of his life, really starting as a young boy, raising bodhicitta, as a young teenager, going to be ordained and study a mountier, studying with Myozen, thank you. And then leaving to go to China, which was not a simple thing, just to find a teacher, just to find a true teacher. I mean, think about all the things that our ancestors had to do to encounter the Dharma. And think of the, in that effort, not only what must have been driving them, their motivation, and the strength of that, but also think about the mind that that effort and those risks that they were taking and those hardships that they had to endure. Think of the mind that that would bring forth. Of eagerness, enthusiasm, hunger. And so one particular set of teaching says that first we have to have been born human, that this is a human thing. The Buddha taught for sentient beings, human beings. Although all sentient beings can benefit from our enlightenment, and they deserve that from us, that we have to be a human being in order to encounter the Dharma. We have to be born in a place where the Dharma is actually exists, is being taught, can be encountered. We have to have sufficiently intact or present or healthy mental, physical faculties so that we can hear and understand and reflect and do what practice requires, because it is all about our physical and mental faculties. That's what we're using. We have to have a lifestyle, be living a life that is conducive to practice. Then, in a sense, allows it, makes it possible. We have to encounter a teacher. And we have to have faith. And in this particular set of requirements, faith is considered the most important of all. To have faith, to deeply trust. I mean, just think about how it is if you don't have faith, how it is perhaps this week or at moments when you have doubted, not just doubted yourself, but doubted the Dharma, doubted your teacher, doubted the path. It's just like you can hear the sound of doors shutting. But when we have faith, when we trust, when we have confidence, even if we are struggling, Sesshin is a road within a road. It's a path within the path. It opens up a way to the Dharma, to ourselves, to the study, to mindfulness, to samadhi, through intensive practice, that there is something that happens in a moment of shift, a moment of opening, a moment of insight, a moment of settling, a moment of release. But then the moment's gone. There is something else that happens when there is sustained effort, sustained practice, continuous practice. Different possibilities that appear. And so Sesshin is really sitting within the three treasures continuously. And in no small part, Sesshin really is a sort of a very deep dive into those different ways of understanding the middle way, into the middle path between self-denial and self-grasping, the middle path between silence and speech, between stillness and activity, between one and the many, between effort, great effort, and relaxation, between aspiration and no expectations. In the fascicle on Old Mirror by Dogen, he said, what all Buddhas and ancestors have maintained and transmitted, person to person, is an old mirror. This is one scene, one face, one image, one casting, one practice, one realization. When the old comes, the old appears. When the new comes, the new appears. When a Buddha comes, a Buddha appears. When an ancestor comes, an ancestor appears. When there's no hindrance in the mind, when there's no projection, there's no anticipation, there's no past, then whatever appears before the mirror is seen, nothing more, nothing less. And that is this wondrous art, is to open this mirror clear and fresh, to brighten that jewel mirror of your own mind and let it see perfectly, without bias, without judgment, whatever appears before it. And so the teaching about not judging, not naming, not projecting, not adding, not subtracting is just that. And so to free ourselves of all of those dualities of right and wrong, of like and dislike, more or less, of even holding on and letting go. And what's important is not only that we are practicing that, but we actually allow it. We allow the mind to be this mirror. We allow that when a Buddha comes, a Buddha appears. We actually allow that. And we might think, well, who wouldn't? Well, most, I think. Even in experiencing mindfulness and deepening aspects of mindfulness, as that brings us into a state of concentration, of right samadhi, all of the different ways in which the mind rebels, the body rebels, it's not familiar. It means letting go of control, of the witness, of managing. You know, we are creatures of habit. Perhaps all creatures are creatures of habit. In the animal realm, we might think of that as instinct. Right? And Buddhism characterizes the animal realm as not only animals who are subject to the whims of humans, and so being worked and raised for slaughter and so on, but that they are bound to instinct. Right? So, with the coming of fall, a whole gaggle of Canadian geese are getting ready to leave, and one of them says, you know what? Every year we do this, and you know what? I don't think I'm going to go. I'm going to check it out. Like, what happens when we go? Right? We leave. What happens when we leave? Maybe it's really great. And the other geese look at them and say, what are you even talking about? They don't even understand the language. So that didn't seem to happen. So we have our own habits, our own instincts. And if we think about how much of our time throughout our life has been spent in thought without mindfulness, so we call that distractedness, or various levels of distractedness. And so not only has that habit of just ongoing thought, of sort of unconscious thought, been such, established itself as such a deep, deep, deep habit, which means it's extremely familiar. It's so familiar that we don't notice it in the beginning. Don't even notice it. But not only is the distraction itself or the ongoing thought itself a habit, but not knowing it is a habit too. Not being aware, not being mindful is a habit. And so when that is, when we start to establish that, that the mind begins to actually hold something in its view, in its perception, like the breath. And there's a moment of holding, and then it's gone. Then there's a moment of holding, then it's gone. And then it's gone. And that's pretty familiar. That's reasonably comfortable. The difference is now that we're seeing it. So that's newer. But then as that mindfulness begins to gain some stability, and there's the capacity to actually sustain it, we hold it a little bit longer, but then it goes. We hold it a bit longer, then it goes. Then it goes. And that as that, the door is really open and we're ready, the mind is ready to take that further, to reclaim that natural capacity at a deeper level. It's very common that there's anxiety. There's the mind that willfully, sometimes consciously, turns away and goes seeking movement again, something, because it's not familiar. And so we have to hold, we have to notice that and then hold that awareness. We have to hold our mindfulness through that anxiety, lightly, but with some effort, And then what happens is that the whole system begins to calm. It's like it calms through past that nervousness. And then that becomes familiar. It doesn't startle us. It doesn't disrupt. And the experience of that, the benefit of that, if you will, the goodness of that begins to, as that increases, it begins to get greater than the pleasure of all of our various fantasies and escapades in our mind. You know, if you think about it, in the very beginning of practice, those easily obtained pleasures of thought are so available, and they're much greater in pleasure than the, for the most part, than the sort of good experiences that come from meditation, because those are not really developed. We haven't encountered much of that yet. And so that's another reason why it's so easy to keep turning towards those various ways in which we can indulge our mind and have some pleasure, right? Take us away a bit. Because that pleasure still feels pretty good. And to let go of that and come back to meditation, which sometimes is still challenging and difficult, you know, it doesn't seem like much of a bargain. And so that's why the faith is important. That we have faith that if we continue, that's going to change. And we can have faith because we hear these consistent voices, innumerable voices from those who have come before us speaking to this. To be wrong is auspicious. There is no contradiction. Another translation says, do not oppose it. We think of wrong as wrong, that wrong is not auspicious. But what Dungshan is talking about, remember that he's speaking this jewel mirror samadhi, which is free of dualities, right? Is free within suchness, is free within the non-duality of all things. And so to be right, to be wrong, you know, these are necessary creations of our mind. They're necessary because they help us to navigate the world. We have to recognize, we have to first establish what are the rights and what are the wrongs. And so moral teachings of every religious tradition do that. We have to know what helps us on this path of awakening and what does not. What creates suffering and what doesn't. And so we wouldn't be able to recognize our suffering otherwise, our unskillful habits, our attachments. And so in Buddhism, right and wrong is really, for the most part, being seen in relationship to the path itself, not just as something that exists in space, but as something that is connected to the path, because that includes the goodness of everything and everyone. Because to be creating suffering in any direction for any being is to be creating suffering. The thing is to just not turn right and wrong into absolutes, into something that has an existence of its own, to not let it become a dogma, and not to become dogmatic in our mind, because that is just more attachment. Longchenpa said, all things are equal. There's no discerning this or that. They're a naked state of emptiness, free from extremes, like space itself. That is, all things exist within a naked state of emptiness, free from extremes, like space. A vast expanse appearing, yet empty, like emanated apparitions. Thus, all things come naturally to be realized. We come to realize all things as this. When the nature of mind is seen, he said, it is nirvana, there from the beginning. It is primal wisdom, free from all fixation. And so to come closer to this, to realize this, we ourselves have to become free of all fixation. So we're really practicing to manifest the whole body and mind, the whole system, in a way that is in accord with the Dharma, which is the real nature of things all the time. Which is why when we move closer to that, there's a sense of affirmation, of harmony, of peace, of rightness. Something good is happening. In the same way that when we move away from it, it's not so good. Innately pure, moreover subtle, no connection with delusion or enlightenment. Causes and conditions have their own time and season, tranquil and illuminating. Innately pure, subtle, no connection with delusion or enlightenment. This mirror, this Buddha nature, it is not like something. And arising from this basic space of emptiness, based in karma causes and the conditions necessary for anything to come into being, things appear. Ta-da! Like a magical apparition. That's why one of the examples is used of a magician creating illusions. There is something there. We see it. That's the thrill of it, of the magic show. But it's not as it appears. And so he says there's no connection to delusion or enlightenment. The Gargana in the Mula Majjhimaka Karika, his teaching on the middle way, talked about, had a chapter on connections, things connecting, right? And one of the amazing things about that work is he takes all of these things that we kind of don't often think about because they just seem so self-evident, so self-obvious, right? Like there is a connection between one thing and another. And so he says the visible object, vision itself, and the seer do not connect with one another. Connection is of one distinct thing with another distinct thing. So we understand that in order for perception to happen, there has to be a visual, for visual perception, there has to be eyes, there has to be a visual object, and there has to be consciousness. And what he's saying is that, yes, that's true, but in that there is no connection between any of those conditions. Why? Because in order for there to be connection, each has to be distinct from the other. For two things to connect, there have to be two things that are distinct and then touch. But before they touch, they have to be existing, self-existing. And he says, and this distinctness does not exist. When we look for it, we can't find it. Thus, they do not connect. He said, a distinct thing cannot be distinct without that from which it is distinct. The eye cannot be distinct from the object, or the eye itself cannot be distinct apart from the thing from which it is distinct. Distinction means distinct from something. And distinctness cannot be found in what is distinct. Not being found, there is no distinctness. When we look at the eye and try to find something that exists by itself, on its own, when we look at seeing or hearing or tasting or touching or thinking, and try to find the thing itself, try to encounter the thing that is seeing, it cannot be found. Well, then how does it come into our perception at the same moment? mutually. That's why they are the conditions for perception. They all have to be arising at the same moment. They come into existence for that moment, at that moment, and then there is perception. And so if you think about that in terms of the connection between ourselves, our awareness, and our delusion. So we have an emotion, a strong emotion of sadness or anger or mean-spiritedness. We find ourselves trashing someone, not liking someone, disliking someone in our mind, and doing an inventory of all the reasons why, or their qualities, or their behavior, or what they did to us. And what he's saying is that there is that the person, their behavior, the action, the image in our mind, the visual, the audible, and the consciousness which is perceiving, that none of those things are actually touching. That the person does not exist as an object of their own, and then we just happen to turn our mind towards them and perceive what is already there, something that exists by itself on its own. Or we perceive something and think this is right, or we perceive something and think this is wrong. And that sense of right and wrong is in the thing. And what he's saying is that is not actually, not only is that thought the way it is, but that is not what we ourselves will discover. And in order to see that deeply, the mind has to become attuned. It has to become a fertile ground for that subtle, pure awareness. And so all of our inner judging, our criticizing, our elevating, our denigrating can only happen when two things are set apart. Right, you remember when Elizabeth Matus Namgyal was teaching last year, and she used one of the examples in the Gargin of two sticks, you know, holding up two sticks. One is short and one is long. Right? We would all agree. This one is short. You have to imagine it in your mind, in my hand, and this one is long. Right? But then if you take away this stick and you bring forth a smaller stick than this one, where did the longness go? Where is the shortness of this stick? Right? In a way, it's a very simple way of helping us to begin to reflect on the assumptions that we make, that these qualities exist within the object by themselves, rather than everything is in a state of mutuality. Even in a moment of pain, you're sitting and there's pain. And we might say, but that just hurts. It just hurts. In my mind, I'm not comparing it to anything. Are you sure? It is entirely within the mind's capacity, its natural capacity, for in that moment of experience, for there to be no mutuality, no past, no other experience of pain to compare it with. This is samadhi. When the mind exists undisturbed in the way, then all the many things lose their offending quality. And when something ceases to offend us, ceases to be experienced in terms of offense or reward, they cease to exist in the old way. There's still something there, but they don't exist in the old way. They don't exist with those inherent qualities. And so Dungshan says, fine enough to penetrate where there is no space, large enough to transcend every boundary. I think of Padmasambhava, who said, my mind is as vast and boundless as the sky. And my actions, my behavior, is as fine as flour. Being off by the fraction of a hair's breadth, the attunement of major and minor keys is lost. Another translation said, then you would be out of harmony. So being off by a fraction And usually we think of that as the slightest movement of mind or the slightest thought. But if no phenomena have inherently within them the power to obstruct, if no phenomena has within it an absolute sense of right or wrong, of good or bad, of bondage or liberation, then that must be true of thoughts. Which means the thoughts themselves do not bind us. They do not delude us. Because otherwise that can sound like striving for perfection, perfection being never having a single stray thought. But remember, to be wrong is auspicious. There is no contradiction. Thinking or not thinking. Thinking, non-thinking. And so when we fall into setting up what we like against what we dislike, thoughts are bad. In that very thought, they become something. We infuse them with properties that they don't actually have. But now we experience them as having that property, those properties. And so in that, the music becomes discordant. Conflicts and confusion, unhappiness and anger. And the thing is, it's like listening to an out-of-tune instrument, playing with other instruments. If we listen to it long enough, our ear will eventually will begin to accommodate it. We'll cease to hear it. I'm pretty sure that's true. I've never actually tested it. But I'm just thinking about how we, the profound capacity we have to get used to anything. Our mind accommodates. You know, I read this years ago, this study of where they made glasses that inverted everything. So they put people into a room, just a blank room, four walls and a door, and they put on these glasses where everything in the room is upside down. Maybe it wasn't a bare room, I don't know. And so everything is upside down. So needless to say, it's very confusing and disconcerting, and a person stumbles a lot. But after a certain amount of time, the brain inverts the inversion, and upside down becomes right side up. How about them apples? So that's amazing, right? It's like the mind's ability, need to help us take topsy-turvy and make it right side up. Well, that's good if you're sentenced to a life with upside down glasses, but what if it's delusion? What if it's the discordancy of our mind? What if it's a false view? What happens when our aspiration, our efforts to actually find connection, create conflict and strife? What if our desire for happiness moves us further and further away from it, and we just become more and more and more accommodating to that? Now there is sudden and gradual, Dongshan says. Sudden and gradual enlightenment, in order to establish the fundamental guidelines. When the fundamental guidelines are clear, they become the rule. And so in the Buddhist tradition from the beginning, I mean, think about it, the Buddha was enlightened. There's no Eightfold Path, there's no training, there's no teachings yet. Nothing. He hasn't started speaking yet. He hasn't encountered a student yet. He hasn't encountered delusion now from within his enlightenment. Think about that. And so in encountering the first student, for the students of his earlier ascetic life, he had to begin teaching, right? He had to formulate, he had to put it into words, the path, a way. And so there was the arising of establishing fundamental guidelines, which become the rule. And I believe in this sense, Dongshan is talking about the way, And so we speak of all of these practices and teachings and stages and levels and progress and realization and then further development to help us develop and move along the path. The Buddha could have said, if you are seeking a life of peace and equanimity, you are already such a person. So don't worry about it. See ya. We probably wouldn't be here. And so he spent his whole life formulating and refining these guidelines, which have now continued and have continued to be developed. So they are enormously helpful, enormously essential, and they can also become attachments. And so to truly take refuge in the Dharma, to truly have respect for the three treasures, we practice not grasping at them. Realization of the basic principle is the ultimate standard, genuine, constant, yet flowing, real, ever-present. It is something we take refuge in. It is something we practice. It is something we realize. It is something that is taught, and yet it is never fixed in time or space or anything. When we attach, when we grasp, Dungshan says, eternally, externally calm, internally shaking, like a tethered horse or a mouse frozen by fright. The former sages, having compassion for such people, made a gift of the Dharma. In their topsy-turvy state, people take black for white, enlightenment for delusion, good for bad, true for false. And Master Sheng Yen, in speaking about this, says these lines especially address people who practice samadhi. Chan is not opposed to samadhi, but it is opposed to attachment to the samadhi experience. In other words, it is not teaching that we should attach to samadhi. He says samadhi is better than any other worldly experience, and yet there's tremendous risk of becoming attached to it. Some people would rather die than come out of it. Samadhi produces a calm mind, a stable mind, and some wisdom will manifest. In other words, we do have insights. It does transform. He says it enhances strong faith in the practice, but it is not chan. The tethered horse and the frozen mouse refer to such a mind. The mind is contained. The vexations are tamed. Right? Our agitations are tamed, but they will still arise. They're not yet freed. They're not yet liberated. And so the ultimate matter, the great matter, has not yet been resolved. He said it's like an active volcano. It may look beautiful and serene, but at any moment it can erupt. And so to a person in samadhi relaxes but does not liberate their vexations. When their samadhi subsides, the vexations will reemerge. Such practitioners are followers of the upside-down ways. Samadhi is a temporary worldly experience. And even as we practice more and more and gain more stability, that experience of samadhi, that experience of mindfulness becomes more and more natural. It's not so hit and miss, so come and gone. In other words, nothing is permanent. But our basic state, our basic mind, becomes more and more in a state of mindfulness and very easily, or rather easily, or more easily, found concentration or samadhi. But it's still impermanent because it's subject to our practice, subject to how we're using our mind, which is all just a way of saying that as important as it is, this jewel mirror of samadhi, that it is ultimately freeing our understanding, liberating our understanding. When topsy-turvy thinking disappears, the acquiescent mind is self-acknowledged, or we realize the mind of our own accord. We see self-nature for what it is, peaceful, complete, undisturbed by our distractedness, by our thoughts, by our emotions, by our attachments. And yet, the body and mind, our physical and mental system, is disturbed until this all becomes more clear. Thoreau said, speaking about nature, for which this is very true, but I think of it as Dharma, all nature, all Dharma, is doing its best each moment to make us well. It exists for no other purpose. Do not resist it. With the least inclination to be well, we should not be sick. This Dharma exists for no other purpose than for us to heal, to see ourselves and others clearly, to alleviate suffering. With the slightest inclination to be well, to come home, to be of service, we should practice no longer perpetuating our sickness.
Thank you for listening. To find out more about ZMM's programs, retreats, and residency, please visit us online at zmm.org.